60% from 1930 to 2010, with a slight decrease toward the end of the period. British and U.S. rates fell from 80 to 90% in 1930 to 1980 to 30 to 40% in 1980 to 2010, with a low point of 28% after the Reagan tax reform of 1986. See PDF figure 14.1. The Anglo-Saxon countries have played yo-yo with the wealthy since the 1930s. By contrast, attitudes toward top incomes in both continental Europe, of which Germany and France are fairly typical, and Japan have held steady. I showed in Part 1 that part of the explanation for this difference might be that the United States and Britain came to feel that they were being overtaken by other countries in the 1970s. This sense that other countries were catching up contributed to the rise of Thatcherism and Reaganism. To be sure, the catch-up that occurred between 1950 and 1980 was largely a mechanical consequence of the shocks endured by continental Europe and Japan between 1914 and 1945. The people of Britain and the United States nevertheless found it hard to accept, for countries as well as individuals, the wealth hierarchy is not just about money, it is also a matter of honor and moral values. What were the consequences of this great shift in attitudes in the United States and Britain? If we look at all the developed countries, we find that the size of the decrease in the top marginal income tax rate between 1980 and the present is closely related to the size of the increase in the top centile's share of national income over the same period. Concretely, the two phenomena are perfectly correlated. The countries with the largest decreases in their top tax rates are also the countries where the top earners' share of national income has increased the most, especially when it comes to the remuneration of executives of large firms. Conversely, the countries that did not reduce their top tax rates very much saw much more moderate increases in the top earners' share of national income. If one believes the classic economic models based on the theory of marginal productivity and the labor supply, one might try to explain this by arguing that the decrease in top tax rates spurred top executive talent to increase their labor supply and productivity. Since their marginal productivity increased, their salaries increased commensurately, and therefore rose well above executive salaries in other countries. This explanation is not very plausible, however. As I showed in Chapter 9, the theory of marginal productivity runs into serious conceptual and economic difficulties, in addition to suffering from a certain naivete, when it comes to explaining how pay is determined at the top of the income hierarchy. A more realistic explanation is that lower top income tax rates, especially in the United States and Britain, where top rates fell dramatically, totally transformed the way executive salaries are determined. It is always difficult for an executive to convince other parties involved in the firm, direct subordinates, workers lower down in the hierarchy, stockholders, and members of the compensation committee, that a large pay raise, say of $1 million, is truly justified. In the 1950s and 1960s, executives in British and U.S. firms had little reason to fight for such raises, and other interested parties were less inclined to accept them, because 80 to 90% of the increase would in any case go directly to the government. After 1980, the game was utterly transformed, however, and the evidence suggests that executives went to considerable lengths to persuade other interested parties to grant them substantial raises. Because it is objectively difficult to measure individual contributions to a firm's output, top managers found it relatively easy to persuade boards and stockholders that they were worth the money, especially since the members of compensation committees were often chosen in a rather incestuous manner. Furthermore, this bargaining power explanation is consistent with the fact that there is no statistically significant relationship between the decrease in top marginal tax rates and the rate of productivity growth in the developed countries since 1980. Concretely, the crucial fact is that the rate of per capita GDP growth has been almost exactly the same in all the rich countries since 1980. In contrast to what many people in Britain and the United States believe, the true figures on growth, as best one can judge from official national accounts data, show that Britain and the United States have not grown any more rapidly since 1980 than Germany, France, Japan, Denmark, or Sweden. In other words, the reduction of top marginal income tax rates and the rise of top incomes do not seem to have stimulated productivity, contrary to the predictions of supply-side theory, or at any rate did not stimulate productivity enough to be statistically detectable at the macro level. Considerable confusion exists around these issues because comparisons are often made over periods of just a few years, a procedure that can be used to justify virtually any conclusion. Or, one forgets to correct for population growth, which is the primary reason for the structural difference in GDP growth between the United States and Europe. Sometimes the level of per capita output, which has always been about 20% higher in the United States, in 1970 to 1980, as well as 2000 to 2010, is confused with the growth rate, which has been about the same on both continents over the past three decades. But the principal source of confusion is probably the catch-up phenomenon mentioned above. There can be no doubt that British and U.S. decline ended in the 1970s, in the sense that growth rates in Britain and the United States, which had been lower than growth rates in Germany, France, Scandinavia, and Japan, ceased to be so. But it is also incontestable that the reason for this convergence is quite simple. Europe and Japan had caught up with the United States and Britain. Clearly, this had little to do with the conservative revolution in the latter two countries in the 1980s, at least to a first approximation. No doubt these issues are too strongly charged with emotion and too closely bound up with national identities and pride to allow for calm examination. Did Maggie Thatcher save Britain? Would Bill Gates's innovations have existed without Ronald Reagan? Will Rhenish capitalism devour the French social model? In the face of such powerful existential anxieties, reason is often at a loss, especially since it is objectively quite difficult to draw perfectly precise and absolutely unassailable conclusions on the basis of growth rate comparisons that reveal differences of a few tenths of a percent. As for Bill Gates and Ronald Reagan, each with his own cult of personality, did Bill invent the computer or just the mouse? Did Ronnie destroy the USSR single-handedly or with the help of the Pope? It may be useful to recall that the U.S. economy was much more innovative in 1950 to 1970 than in 1990 to 2010, to judge by the fact that productivity growth was nearly twice as high in the former period as in the latter. And since the United States was in both periods at the world technology frontier, this difference must be related to the pace of innovation. A new argument has recently been advanced. It is possible that the U.S. economy has become more innovative in recent years, but that this innovation does not show up in the productivity figures because it's spilled over into the other wealthy countries, which have thrived on U.S. inventions. It would nevertheless be quite astonishing if the United States, which has not always been hailed for international altruism, Europeans regularly complain about U.S. carbon emissions, while the poor countries complain about American stinginess, were proven not to have retained some of this enhanced productivity for itself. In theory, that is the purpose of patents. Clearly, the debate is nowhere close to over. In an attempt to make some progress on these issues, Emmanuel Saez, Stephanie Stancheva, and I have tried to go beyond international comparisons and to make use of a new database containing information about executive compensation in listed companies throughout the developed world. Our findings suggest that skyrocketing executive pay is fairly well explained by the bargaining model. Lower marginal tax rates encourage executives to negotiate harder for higher pay, and does not have much to do with a hypothetical increase in managerial productivity. we again found that the elasticity of executive pay is greater with respect to luck, that is, variations in earnings that cannot have been due to executive talent, because, for instance, other firms in the same sector did equally well, than with respect to talent, variations not explained by sector variables. As I explained in Chapter 9, this finding poses serious problems for the view that high executive pay is a reward for good performance. Furthermore, we found that elasticity with respect to luck, broadly speaking, the ability of executives to obtain raises, not clearly justified by economic performance, was higher in countries where the top marginal tax rate was lower. Finally, we found that variations in the marginal tax rate can explain why executive pay rose sharply in some countries and not in others. In particular, variations in company size and in the importance of the financial sector definitely cannot explain the observed facts. Similarly, the idea that skyrocketing executive pay is due to lack of competition, and that more competitive markets and better corporate governance and control would put an end to it, seems unrealistic. Our findings suggest that only dissuasive taxation of the sort applied in the United States and Britain before 1980 can do the job. In regard to such a complex and comprehensive question, which involves political, social, and cultural, as well as economic factors, it is obviously impossible to be totally certain. That is the beauty of the social sciences. It is likely, for instance, that social norms concerning executive pay directly influence the levels of compensation we observe in different countries, independent of the influence of tax rates. Nevertheless, the available evidence suggests that our explanatory model gives the best explanation of the observed facts. Rethinking the question of the top marginal rate. These findings have important implications for the desirable degree of fiscal progressivity. Indeed, they indicate that levying confiscatory rates on top incomes is not only possible, but also the only way to stem the observed increase in very high salaries. According to our estimates, the optimal top tax rate in the developed countries is probably above 80%. Do not be misled by the apparent precision of this estimate. No mathematical formula or econometric estimate can tell us exactly what tax rate ought to be applied to what level of income. Only collective deliberation and democratic experimentation can do that. What is certain, however, is that our estimates pertain to extremely high levels of income, those observed in the top 1% or 0.5% of the income hierarchy. The evidence suggests that a rate on the order of 80% on incomes over $500,000 or $1 million a year not only would not reduce the growth of the U.S. economy, but would in fact distribute the fruits of growth more widely while imposing reasonable limits on economically useless or even harmful behavior. Obviously, it would be easier to apply such a policy in a country the size of the United States than in a small European country where close fiscal coordination with neighboring countries is lacking. I say more about international coordination in the next chapter. Here, I will simply note that the United States is big enough to apply this type of fiscal policy effectively. The idea that all U.S. executives would immediately flee to Canada and Mexico, and no one with the competence or motivation to run the economy would remain, is not only contradicted by historical experience and by all the firm-level data at our disposal, it is also devoid of common sense. A rate of 80% applied to incomes above $500,000 or $1 million a year would not bring the government much in the way of revenue, because it would quickly fulfill its objective. To drastically reduce remuneration at this level, but without reducing the productivity of the U.S. economy, so that pay would rise at lower levels. In order for the government to obtain the revenues it sorely needs to develop the meager U.S. social state and invest more in health and education, while reducing the federal deficit, taxes would also have to be raised on incomes lower in the distribution. For example, by imposing rates of 50 or 60% on incomes above $200,000. Such a social and fiscal policy is well within the reach of the United States. Nevertheless, it seems quite unlikely that any such policy will be adopted anytime soon. It is not even certain that the top marginal income tax rate in the United States will be raised as high as 40% in Obama's second term. Has the U.S. political process been captured by the 1%? This idea has become increasingly popular among observers of the Washington political scene. For reasons of natural optimism as well as professional predilection, I am inclined to grant more influence to ideas and intellectual debate. Careful examination of various hypotheses and bodies of evidence, and access to better data, can influence political debate and perhaps push the process in a direction more favorable to the general interest. For example, as I noted in Part 3, U.S. economists often underestimate the increase in top incomes because they rely on inadequate data, especially survey data that fails to capture the very highest incomes. As a result, they pay too much attention to wage gaps between workers with different skill levels, a crucial question for the long run, but not very relevant to understanding why the 1% have pulled so far ahead, the dominant phenomenon from a macroeconomic point of view. The use of better data, in particular tax data, may therefore ultimately focus attention on the right questions. That said, the history of the progressive tax over the course of the 20th century suggests that the risk of a drift toward oligarchy is real and gives little reason for optimism about where the United States is headed. It was war that gave rise to progressive taxation, not the natural consequences of universal suffrage. The experience of France in the Belle Époque proves, if proof were needed, that no hypocrisy is too great when economic and financial elites are obliged to defend their interests. And that includes economists, who currently occupy an enviable place in the U.S. income hierarchy. Some economists have an unfortunate tendency to defend their private interest while implausibly claiming to champion the general interest. Although data on this are sparse, it also seems that U.S. politicians of both parties are much wealthier than their European counterparts, and in a totally different category from the average American, which might explain why they tend to confuse their own private interest with the general interest. Without a radical shock, it seems fairly likely that the current equilibrium will persist for quite some time. The egalitarian pioneer ideal has faded into oblivion, and the new world may be on the verge of becoming the old Europe of the 21st century's globalized economy. Chapter 15. A Global Tax on Capital. To regulate the globalized patrimonial capitalism of the 21st century, rethinking the 20th century fiscal and social model and adapting it to today's world will not be enough. To be sure, appropriate updating of the last century's social democratic and fiscal liberal program is essential, as I tried to show in the previous two chapters, which focused on two fundamental institutions that were invented in the 20th century and must continue to play a central role in the future: the social state and the progressive income tax. But if democracy is to regain control over the globalized financial capitalism of this century, it must also invent new tools, adapted to today's challenges. The ideal tool would be a progressive global tax on capital, coupled with a very high level of international financial transparency. Such a tax would provide a way to avoid an endless inegalitarian spiral and to control the worrisome dynamics of global capital concentration. Whatever tools and regulations are actually decided on need to be measured against this ideal. I will begin by analyzing practical aspects of such a tax, and then proceed to more general reflections about the regulation of capitalism from the prohibition of usury to Chinese capital controls. A Global Tax on Capital. A Useful Utopia. A global tax on capital is a utopian idea. It is hard to imagine the nations of the world agreeing on any such thing anytime soon. To achieve this goal, they would have to establish a tax schedule applicable to all wealth around the world, and then decide how to apportion the revenues. But if the idea is utopian, it is nevertheless useful for several reasons. First, even if nothing resembling this ideal is put into practice in the foreseeable future, it can serve as a worthwhile reference point, a standard against which alternative proposals can be measured. Admittedly, a global tax on capital would require a very high and no doubt unrealistic level of international cooperation. But countries wishing to move in this direction could very well do so incrementally, starting at the regional level, in Europe, for instance. Unless something like this happens, a defensive reaction of a nationalist stripe would very likely occur. For example, one might see a return to various forms of protectionism coupled with imposition of capital controls. Because such policies are seldom effective, however, they would very likely lead to frustration and increase international tensions. Protectionism and capital controls are actually unsatisfactory substitutes for the ideal form of regulation, which is a global tax on capital. A solution that has the merit of preserving economic openness while effectively regulating the global economy and justly distributing the benefits among and within nations. Many people will reject the global tax on capital as a dangerous illusion, just as the income tax was rejected in its time, a little more than a century ago. When looked at closely, however, this solution turns out to be far less dangerous than the alternatives. To reject the global tax on capital out of hand would be all the more regrettable because it is perfectly possible to move toward this ideal solution step by step, first at the continental or regional level, and then by arranging for closer cooperation among regions. One can see a model for this sort of approach in the recent discussions on automatic sharing of bank data between the United States and the European Union. Furthermore, various forms of capital taxation already exist in most countries, especially in North America and Europe, and these could obviously serve as starting points. The capital controls that exist in China and other emerging countries also hold useful lessons for all. There are nevertheless important differences between these existing measures and the ideal tax on capital. First, the proposals for automatic sharing of banking information currently under discussion are far from comprehensive. Not all asset types are included, and the penalties envisioned are clearly insufficient to achieve the desired results, despite new U.S. banking regulations that are more ambitious than any that exist in Europe. The debate is only beginning, and it is unlikely to produce tangible results unless relatively heavy sanctions are imposed on banks, and even more, on countries that thrive on financial opacity. The issue of financial transparency and information sharing is closely related to the ideal tax on capital. Without a clear idea of what all the information is to be used for, current data sharing proposals are unlikely to achieve the desired result. To my mind, the objective ought to be a progressive annual tax on individual wealth. That is, on the net value of assets each person controls. For the wealthiest people on the planet, the tax would thus be based on individual net worth, the kinds of numbers published by Forbes and other magazines. And collecting such a tax would tell us whether the numbers published in the magazines are anywhere near correct. For the rest of us, taxable wealth would be determined by the market value of all financial assets, including bank deposits, stocks, bonds, partnerships, and other forms of participation in listed and unlisted firms, and non-financial assets, especially real estate, net of debt. So much for the basis of the tax. At what rate would it be levied? One might imagine a rate of 0% for net assets below 1 million euros, 1% between 1 and 5 million, and 2% above 5 million. Or one might prefer a much more steeply progressive tax on the largest fortunes. For example, a rate of 5 or 10% on assets above 1 billion euros. There might also be advantages to having a minimal rate on modest to average wealth, For example, 0.1% below 200,000 euros and 0.5% between 200,000 and 1 million. I discuss these issues later on. Here, the important point to keep in mind is that the capital tax I am proposing is a progressive annual tax on global wealth. The largest fortunes are to be taxed more heavily, and all types of assets are to be included: real estate, financial assets, and business assets. No exceptions. This is one clear difference between my proposed capital tax and the taxes on capital that currently exist in one country or another, even though important aspects of those existing taxes should be retained. To begin with, nearly every country taxes real estate. The English-speaking countries have property taxes, while France has a taxe foncière. One drawback of these taxes is that they are based solely on real property. Financial assets are ignored, and property is taxed at its market value regardless of debt, so that a heavily indebted person is taxed in the same way as a person with no debt. Furthermore, real estate is generally taxed at a flat rate, or close to it. Still, such taxes exist and generate significant revenue in most developed countries, especially in the English-speaking world, typically 1 to 2% of national income. Furthermore, property taxes in some countries, such as the United States, rely on fairly sophisticated assessment procedures with automatic adjustment to changing market values, procedures that ought to be generalized and extended to other asset classes. In some European countries, including France, Switzerland, Spain, and until recently Germany and Sweden, there are also progressive taxes on total wealth. Superficially, these taxes are closer in spirit to the ideal capital tax I am proposing. In practice, however, they are often riddled with exemptions. Many asset classes are left out, while others are assessed at arbitrary values having nothing to do with their market value. That is why several countries have moved to eliminate such taxes. It is important to heed the lessons of these various experiences in order to design an appropriate capital tax for the century ahead. Democratic and financial transparency. What tax schedule is ideal for my proposed capital tax, and what revenues should we expect such a tax to produce? Before I attempt to answer these questions, note that the proposed tax is in no way intended to replace all existing taxes. It would never be more than a fairly modest supplement to the other revenue streams on which the modern social state depends. A few points of national income, 3 or 4 at most, still nothing to sneeze at. The primary purpose of the capital tax is not to finance the social state, but to regulate capitalism. The goal is first to stop the indefinite increase of inequality of wealth, and second, to impose effective regulation on the financial and banking system in order to avoid crises. To achieve these two ends, the capital tax must first promote democratic and financial transparency. There should be clarity about who owns what assets around the world. Why is the goal of transparency so important? Imagine a very low global tax on capital, say a flat rate of 0.1% a year on all assets. The revenue from such a tax would, of course, be limited by design. If the global stock of private capital is about 5 years of global income, the tax would generate revenue equal to 0.5% of global income, with minor variations from country to country according to their capital income ratio, assuming that the tax is collected in the country where the owner of the asset resides and not where the asset itself is located, an assumption that can by no means be taken for granted. Even so, such a limited tax would already play a very useful role. First, it would generate information about the distribution of wealth. National governments, international organizations, and statistical offices around the world would at last be able to produce reliable data about the evolution of global wealth. Citizens would no longer be forced to rely on Forbes, glossy financial reports from global wealth managers, and other unofficial sources to fill the official statistical void, Recall that I explored the deficiencies of those unofficial sources in Part 3. Instead, they would have access to public data based on clearly prescribed methods and information provided under penalty of law. The benefit to democracy would be considerable. It is very difficult to have a rational debate about the great challenges facing the world today, the future of the social state, the cost of the transition to new sources of energy, state building in the developing world, and so on, because the global distribution of wealth remains so opaque. Some people think that the world's billionaires have so much money that it would be enough to tax them at a low rate to solve all the world's problems. Others believe that there are so few billionaires that nothing much would come of taxing them more heavily. As we saw in Part 3, the truth lies somewhere between these two extremes. In macroeconomic terms, one probably has to descend a bit in the wealth hierarchy to fortunes of 10 to 100 million euros rather than 1 billion, to obtain a tax basis large enough to make a difference. I have also discovered some objectively disturbing trends. Without a global tax on capital or some similar policy, there is a substantial risk that the top centile's share of global wealth will continue to grow indefinitely. And this should worry everyone. In any case, truly democratic debate cannot proceed without reliable statistics. The stakes for financial regulation are also considerable. The international organizations currently responsible for overseeing and regulating the global financial system, starting with the IMF, have only a very rough idea of the global distribution of financial assets, and in particular, of the amount of assets hidden in tax havens. As I have shown, the planet's financial accounts are not in balance. Earth seems to be perpetually indebted to Mars. Navigating our way through a global financial crisis blanketed in such a thick statistical fog is fraught with peril. Take, for example, the Cypriot banking crisis of 2013. Neither the European authorities nor the IMF had much information about who exactly owned the financial assets deposited in Cyprus or what amounts they owned. Hence, their proposed solutions proved crude and ineffective. As we will see in the next chapter, greater financial transparency would not only lay the groundwork for a permanent annual tax on capital, it would also pave the way to a more just and efficient management of banking crises like the one in Cyprus, possibly by way of carefully calibrated and progressive special levies on capital. A 0.1% tax on capital would be more in the nature of a compulsory reporting law than a true tax. Everyone would be required to report ownership of capital assets to the world's financial authorities in order to be recognized as the legal owner, with all the advantages and disadvantages thereof. As noted, this was what the French Revolution accomplished with its compulsory reporting and cadastral surveys. The capital tax would be a sort of cadastral financial survey of the entire world, and nothing like it currently exists. It is important to understand that a tax is always more than just a tax. It is also a way of defining norms and categories and imposing a legal framework on economic activity. This has always been the case, especially in regard to land ownership. In the modern era, the imposition of new taxes around the time of World War I required precise definitions of income, wages, and profits. This fiscal innovation, in turn, fostered the development of accounting standards, which had not previously existed. One of the main goals of a tax on capital would thus be to refine the definitions of various asset types and set rules for valuing assets, liabilities, and net wealth. Under the private accounting standards now in force, prescribed procedures are imperfect and often vague. These flaws have contributed to the many financial scandals the world has seen since 2000. Last but not least, a capital tax would force governments to clarify and broaden international agreements concerning the automatic sharing of banking data. The principle is quite simple. National tax authorities should receive all the information they need to calculate the net wealth of every citizen. Indeed, the capital tax should work in the same way as the income tax currently does in many countries, where data on income are provided to the tax authorities by employers via the W-2 and 1099 forms in the United States, for example. There should be similar reporting on capital assets. Indeed, income and capital reporting could be combined into one form. All taxpayers would receive a form listing their assets and liabilities as reported to the tax authorities. Many U.S. states use this method to administer the property tax. Taxpayers receive an annual form indicating the current market value of any real estate they own, as calculated by the government on the basis of observed prices in transactions involving comparable properties. Taxpayers can, of course, challenge these valuations with appropriate evidence. In practice, corrections are rare, because data on real estate transactions are readily available and hard to contest. Nearly everyone is aware of changing real estate values in the local market, and the authorities have comprehensive databases at their disposal. Note, in passing, that this reporting method has two advantages. It makes the taxpayer's life simple and eliminates the inevitable temptation to slightly underestimate the value of one's own property. It is essential and perfectly feasible to extend this reporting system to all types of financial assets and debts. For assets and liabilities associated with financial institutions within national borders, this could be done immediately, since banks, insurance companies, and other financial intermediaries in most developed countries are already required to inform the tax authorities about bank accounts and other assets they administer. In France, for example, the government knows that Monsieur X owns an apartment worth 400,000 euros and a stock portfolio worth 200,000 euros and has 100,000 euros in outstanding debts. It could thus send him a form indicating these various amounts, along with his net worth of 500,000 euros, with a request for corrections and additions if appropriate. This type of automated system, applied to the entire population, is far better adapted to the 21st century than the archaic method of asking all persons to declare honestly how much they own. A simple solution: automatic transmission of banking information. The first step toward a global tax on capital should be to extend to the international level this type of automatic transmission of banking data in order to include information on assets held in foreign banks in the pre-computed asset statements issued to each taxpayer. It is important to recognize that there is no technical obstacle to doing so. Banking data are already automatically shared with the tax authorities in a country with 300 million people like the United States, as well as in countries like France and Germany with populations of 60 and 80 million, respectively. So there is obviously no reason why including the banks in the Cayman Islands and Switzerland would radically increase the volume of data to be processed. Of course, the tax havens regularly invoke other excuses for maintaining bank secrecy. One of these is the alleged worry that governments will misuse the information. This is not a very convincing argument. It is hard to see why it would not also apply to information about the bank accounts of those incautious enough to keep their money in the country where they pay taxes. The most plausible reason why tax havens defend bank secrecy is that it allows their clients to evade their fiscal obligations, thereby allowing the tax havens to share in the gains. Obviously, this has nothing whatsoever to do with the principles of the market economy. No one has the right to set his own tax rates. It is not right for individuals to grow wealthy from free trade and economic integration only to rake off the profits at the expense of their neighbors. That is outright theft. To date, the most thoroughgoing attempt to end these practices is the Foreign Account Tax Compliance Act, FATCA, adopted in the United States in 2010, and scheduled to be phased in by stages in 2014 and 2015. It requires all foreign banks to inform the Treasury Department about bank accounts and investments held abroad by U.S. taxpayers, along with any other sources of revenue from which they might benefit. This is a far more ambitious law than the 2003 EU Directive on Foreign Savings, which concerns only interest-bearing deposit accounts. Equity portfolios are not covered, which is unfortunate, since large fortunes are held primarily in the form of stocks, which are fully covered by FATCA, and applies only to European banks and not worldwide. Again, unlike FATCA. Even though the European directive is timid and almost meaningless, it is not enforced, since, despite numerous discussions and proposed amendments since 2008, Luxembourg and Austria managed to win from other EU member states an agreement to extend their exemption from automatic data reporting and retain their right to share information only on formal request. This system, which also applies to Switzerland and other territories outside the European Union, means that a government must already possess something close to proof of fraud in order to obtain information about the foreign bank accounts of one of its citizens. This obviously limits drastically the ability to detect and control fraud. In 2013, after Luxembourg and Switzerland announced their intention to abide by the provisions of FATCA, discussions in Europe resumed with the intention of incorporating some or all of these in a new EU directive. It is impossible to know when these discussions will conclude or whether they will lead to a legally binding agreement. Note, moreover, that in this realm there is often a chasm between the triumphant declarations of political leaders and the reality of what they accomplish. This is extremely worrisome for the future equilibrium of our democratic societies. It is particularly striking to discover that the countries that are most dependent on substantial tax revenues to pay for their social programs, namely the European countries, are also the ones that have accomplished the least, even though the technical challenges are quite simple. This is a good example of the difficult situation that smaller countries face in dealing with globalization. Nation-states built over centuries find that they are too small to impose and enforce rules on today's globalized patrimonial capitalism. The countries of Europe were able to unite around a single currency, to be discussed more extensively in the next chapter. But they have accomplished almost nothing in the area of taxation. The leaders of the largest countries in the European Union, who naturally bear primary responsibility for this failure, and for the gaping chasm between their words and their actions, nevertheless continue to blame other countries and the institutions of the European Union itself. There is no reason to think that things will change anytime soon. Furthermore, although FATCA is far more ambitious than any EU directive in this realm, it too is insufficient. For one thing, its language is not sufficiently precise or comprehensive, so that there is good reason to believe that certain trust funds and foundations can legally avoid any obligation to report their assets. For another, the sanction envisioned by the law, a 30% surtax on income that non-compliant banks derive from their U.S. operations, is insufficient. It may be enough to persuade certain banks, such as the big Swiss and Luxembourgian institutions that need to do business in the United States, to abide by the law, but there may well be a resurgence of smaller banks that specialize in managing overseas portfolios and do not operate on U.S. soil. Such institutions, whether located in Switzerland, Luxembourg, London, or more exotic locales, can continue to manage the assets of U.S. or European taxpayers without conveying any information to the authorities with complete impunity. Very likely, the only way to obtain tangible results is to impose automatic sanctions, not only on banks, but also on countries that refuse to require their financial institutions to provide the required information. One might contemplate, for example, a tariff of 30% or more on the exports of offending states. To be clear, the goal is not to impose a general embargo on tax havens or engage in an endless trade war with Switzerland or Luxembourg. Protectionism does not produce wealth, and free trade and economic openness are ultimately in everyone's interest, provided that some countries do not take advantage of their neighbors by siphoning off their tax base. The requirement to provide comprehensive banking data automatically should have been part of the free trade and capital liberalization agreements negotiated since 1980. It was not, but that is not a good reason to stick with the status quo forever. Countries that have thrived on financial opacity may find it difficult to accept reform, especially since a legitimate financial services industry often develops alongside illicit or questionable banking activities. The financial services industry responds to genuine needs of the real international economy and will obviously continue to exist no matter what regulations are adopted. Nevertheless, the tax havens will undoubtedly suffer significant losses if financial transparency becomes the norm. Such countries would be unlikely to agree to reform without sanctions, especially since other countries, and in particular the largest countries in the European Union, have not for the moment shown much determination to deal with the problem. Note, moreover, that the construction of the European Union has thus far rested on the idea that each country could have a single market and free capital flows without paying any price, or much of one. Reform is necessary, even indispensable, but it would be naive to think that it will happen without a fight. Because it moves the debate away from the realm of abstractions and high-flown rhetoric and toward concrete sanctions, which are important, especially in Europe, FATCA is useful. Finally, note that neither FATCA nor the EU directives were intended to support a progressive tax on global wealth. Their purpose was primarily to provide the tax authorities with information about taxpayer assets to be used for internal purposes, such as identifying omissions in income tax returns. The information can also be used to identify possible evasion of the estate tax or wealth tax in countries that have one. But the primary emphasis is on enforcement of the income tax. Clearly, these various issues are closely related, and international financial transparency is a crucial matter for the modern fiscal state across the board. What is the purpose of a tax on capital? Suppose next that the tax authorities are fully informed about the net asset position of each citizen. Should they be content to tax wealth at a very low rate of, say, 0.1%, in keeping with the logic of compulsory reporting? Or should a more substantial tax be assessed? And if so, why? The key question can be reformulated as follows. Since a progressive income tax exists, and in most countries, a progressive estate tax as well, what is the purpose of a progressive tax on capital? In fact, these three progressive taxes play distinct and complementary roles. Each is an essential pillar of an ideal tax system. There are two distinct justifications of a capital tax: a contributive justification and an incentive justification. The contributive logic is quite simple. Income is often not a well-defined concept for very wealthy individuals, and only a direct tax on capital can correctly gauge the contributive capacity of the wealthy. Concretely, imagine a person with a fortune of 10 billion euros. As we saw in our examination of the Forbes rankings, fortunes of this magnitude have increased very rapidly over the past three decades, with real growth rates of 6-7% a year, or even higher for the wealthiest individuals, such as Lillian Bettencourt and Bill Gates. By definition, this means that income in the economic sense, including dividends, capital gains, and all other new resources capable of financing consumption and increasing the capital stock, amounted to at least 6-7% of the individual's capital, assuming that virtually none of this is consumed. To simplify things, imagine that the individual in question enjoys an economic income of 5% of her fortune of 10 billion euros, which would be 500 million a year. Now, it is unlikely that such an individual would declare an income of 500 million euros on her income tax return. In France, the United States, and all other countries we have studied, the largest incomes declared on income tax returns are generally no more than a few tens of millions of euros or dollars. Take Lillian Bettencourt, the L'Oréal heiress and the wealthiest person in France. According to information published in the press and revealed by Bettencourt herself, her declared income was never more than 5 million a year, or little more than 1/10,000th of her wealth, which is currently more than 30 billion euros. Uncertainties about individual cases aside, they are of little importance, the income declared for tax purposes in a case like this is less than a hundredth of the taxpayer's economic income. The crucial point here is that no tax evasion or undeclared Swiss bank account is involved, as far as we know. Even a person of the most refined taste and elegance cannot easily spend 500 million euros a year on current expenses. It is generally enough to take a few million a year in dividends, or some other type of payout, while leaving the remainder of the return on one's capital to accumulate in a family trust, or other ad hoc legal entity created for the sole purpose of managing a fortune of this magnitude, just as university endowments are managed. This is perfectly legal and not inherently problematic. Nevertheless, it does present a challenge to the tax system. If some people are taxed on the basis of declared incomes that are only 1% of their economic incomes, or even 10%, then nothing is accomplished by taxing that income at a rate of 50%, or even 98%. The problem is that this is how the tax system works in practice in the developed countries. Effective tax rates, expressed as a percentage of economic income, are extremely low at the top of the wealth hierarchy, which is problematic, since it accentuates the explosive dynamic of wealth inequality, especially when larger fortunes are able to garner larger returns. In fact, the tax system ought to attenuate this dynamic, not accentuate it. There are several ways to deal with this problem. One would be to tax all of a person's income, including the part that accumulates in trusts, holding companies, and partnerships. A simpler solution is to compute the tax due on the basis of wealth rather than income. One could then assume a flat yield of, say, 5% a year, to estimate the income on the capital and include that amount in the income subject to a progressive income tax. Some countries, such as the Netherlands, have tried this, but have run into a number of difficulties having to do with the range of assets covered and the choice of a return on capital. Another solution is to apply a progressive tax directly to an individual's total wealth. The important advantage of this approach is that one can vary the tax rate with the size of the fortune, since we know that in practice, larger fortunes earn larger returns. In view of the finding that fortunes at the top of the wealth hierarchy are earning very high returns, this contributive argument is the most important justification of a progressive tax on capital. According to this reasoning, capital is a better indicator of the contributive capacity of very wealthy individuals than is income, which is often difficult to measure. A tax on capital is thus needed in addition to the income tax for those individuals whose taxable income is clearly too low in light of their wealth. Nevertheless, another classic argument in favor of a capital tax should not be neglected. It relies on a logic of incentives. The basic idea is that a tax on capital is an incentive to seek the best possible return on one's capital stock. Concretely, a tax of 1 or 2% on wealth is relatively light for an entrepreneur who manages to earn 10% a year on her capital. By contrast, it is quite heavy for a person who is content to park her wealth in investments returning at most 2 or 3% a year. According to this logic, the purpose of the tax on capital is thus to force people who use their wealth inefficiently to sell assets in order to pay their taxes, thus ensuring that those assets wind up in the hands of more dynamic investors. There is some validity to this argument, but it should not be overstated. In practice, the return on capital does not depend solely on the talent and effort supplied by the capitalist. For one thing, the average return varies systematically with the size of the initial fortune. For another, individual returns are largely unpredictable and chaotic and are affected by all sorts of economic shocks. For example, there are many reasons why a firm might be losing money at any given point in time. A tax system based solely on the capital stock and not on realized profits would put disproportionate pressure on companies in the red, because their taxes would be as high when they were losing money as when they were earning high profits, and this could plunge them into bankruptcy. The ideal tax system is therefore a compromise between the incentive logic, which favors a tax on the capital stock, and an insurance logic, which favors a tax on the revenue stream stemming from capital. The unpredictability of the return on capital explains, moreover, why it is more efficient to tax heirs not once and for all, at the moment of inheritance, by way of the estate tax, but throughout their lives, via taxes based on both capital income and the value of the capital stock. In other words, all three types of tax, on inheritance, income, and capital, play useful and complementary roles, even if income is perfectly observable for all taxpayers, no matter how wealthy. A blueprint for a European wealth tax. Taking all these factors into account, what is the ideal schedule for a tax on capital, and how much would such a tax bring in? To be clear, I am speaking here of a permanent annual tax on capital at a rate that must therefore be fairly moderate. A tax collected only once a generation, such as an inheritance tax, can be assessed at a very high rate, a third, a half, or even two-thirds, as was the case for the largest estates in Britain and the United States from 1930 to 1980. The same is true of exceptional one-time taxes on capital levied in unusual circumstances, such as the tax levied on capital in France in 1945, at rates as high as 25%, indeed 100% for additions to capital during the occupation, 1940 to 1945. Clearly, such taxes cannot be applied for very long. If the government takes a quarter of the nation's wealth every year, there will be nothing left to tax after a few years. That is why the rates of an annual tax on capital must be much lower, on the order of a few percent. To some, this may seem surprising, but it is actually quite a substantial tax, since it is levied every year on the total stock of capital. For example, the property tax rate is frequently just 0.5 to 1% of the value of real estate, or a tenth to a quarter of the rental value of the property, assuming an average rental return of 4% a year. The next point is important, and I want to insist on it, given the very high level of private wealth in Europe today. A progressive annual tax on wealth at modest rates could bring in significant revenue. Take, for example, a wealth tax of 0% on fortunes below 1 million euros, 1% between 1 and 5 million euros, and 2% above 5 million euros. If applied to all member states of the European Union, such a tax would affect about 2.5% of the population and bring in revenues equivalent to 2% of Europe's GDP. The high return should come as no surprise. It is due simply to the fact that private wealth in Europe today is worth more than 5 years of GDP, and much of that wealth is concentrated in the upper centiles of the distribution. Although a tax on capital would not by itself bring in enough to finance the social state, the additional revenues it would generate are nevertheless significant. In principle, each member state of the European Union could generate similar revenues by applying such a tax on its own. But without automatic sharing of bank information, both inside and outside EU territory, starting with Switzerland, among non-member states, the risks of evasion would be very high. This partly explains why countries that have adopted a wealth tax, such as France, which employs a tax schedule similar to the one I am proposing, generally allows numerous exemptions, especially for business assets, and in practice, for nearly all large stakes in listed and unlisted companies. To do this is to drain much of the content from the progressive tax on capital, and that is why existing taxes have generated revenues so much smaller than the ones described above. An extreme example of the difficulties European countries face when they try to impose a capital tax on their own can be seen in Italy. In 2012, the Italian government, faced with one of the largest public debts in Europe, and also with an exceptionally high level of private wealth, also one of the highest in Europe, along with Spain, decided to introduce a new tax on wealth. But for fear that financial assets would flee the country in search of refuge in Swiss, Austrian, and French banks, the rate was set at 0.8% on real estate and only 0.1% on bank deposits and other financial assets, except stocks, which were totally exempt, with no progressivity. Not only is it hard to think of an economic principle that would explain why some assets should be taxed at 1/8 the rate of others, the system also had the unfortunate consequence of imposing a regressive tax on wealth. Since the largest fortunes consist mainly of financial assets, and especially stocks. This design probably did little to earn social acceptance for the new tax, which became a major issue in the 2013 Italian elections. The candidate who had proposed the tax, with the compliments of European and international authorities, was roundly defeated at the polls. The crux of the problem is this. Without automatic sharing of bank information among European countries, which would allow the tax authorities to obtain reliable information about the net assets of all taxpayers, no matter where those assets are located, it is very difficult for a country acting on its own to impose a progressive tax on capital. This is especially unfortunate because such a tax is a tool particularly well suited to Europe's current economic predicament. Suppose that bank information is automatically shared and the tax authorities have accurate assessments of who owns what, which may happen someday. What would then be the ideal tax schedule? As usual, there is no mathematical formula for answering this question, which is a matter for democratic deliberation. It would make sense to tax net wealth below 200,000 euros at 0.1% and net wealth between 200,000 and 1 million euros at 0.5%. This would replace the property tax, which in most countries is tantamount to a wealth tax on the propertied middle class. The new system would be both more just and more efficient because it targets all assets, not only real estate, and relies on transparent data and market values net of mortgage debt. To a large extent, a tax of this sort could be readily implemented by individual countries acting alone. Note that there is no reason why the tax rate on fortunes above 5 million euros should be limited to 2%. Since the real returns on the largest fortunes in Europe and around the world are 6-7% or more, it would not be excessive to tax fortunes above 100 million or 1 billion euros at rates well above 2%. The simplest and fairest procedure would be to set rates on the basis of observed returns in each wealth bracket over several prior years. In that way, the degree of progressivity can be adjusted to match the evolution of returns to capital and the desired level of wealth concentration. To avoid divergence of the wealth distribution, that is, a steadily increasing share belonging to the top centiles and thousandths, which on its face seems to be a minimal desirable objective, it would probably be necessary to levy rates of about 5% on the largest fortunes. If a more ambitious goal is preferred, say to reduce wealth inequality to more moderate levels than exist today, and which history shows are not necessary for growth, one might envision rates of 10% or higher on billionaires. This is not the place to resolve the issue. What is certain is that it makes little sense to take the yield on public debt as a reference, as is often done in political debate. The largest fortunes are clearly not invested in government bonds. Is a European wealth tax realistic? There is no technical reason why not. It is the tool best suited to meet the economic challenges of the 21st century, especially in Europe, where private wealth is thriving to a degree not seen since the Belle Époque. But if the countries of the old continent are to cooperate more closely, European political institutions will have to change. The only strong European institution at the moment is the ECB, which is important, but notoriously insufficient. I come back to this in the next chapter, when I turn to the question of the public debt crisis. Before that, it will be useful to look at the proposed tax on capital in a broader historical perspective. Capital taxation in historical perspective. In all civilizations, the fact that the owners of capital claim a substantial share of national income without working, and that the rate of return on capital is generally 4 to 5% a year, has provoked vehement, often indignant, reactions, as well as a variety of political responses. One of the most common of the latter has been the prohibition of usury, which we find in one form or another in most religious traditions, including those of Christianity and Islam. The Greek philosophers were of two minds about interest, which, since time never ceases to flow, can in principle increase wealth without limit. It was the danger of limitless wealth that Aristotle singled out when he observed that the word interest in Greek, tokos, means child. In his view, money ought not to give birth to more money. In a world of low or even near zero growth, where both population and output remained more or less the same generation after generation, limitlessness seemed particularly dangerous. Unfortunately, the attempts to prohibit interest were often illogical. The effect of outlawing loans at interest was generally to restrict certain types of investment and certain categories of commercial or financial activity that the political or religious authorities deemed less legitimate or worthy than others. They did not, however, question the legitimacy of returns to capital in general. In the agrarian societies of Europe, the Christian authorities never questioned the legitimacy of land rents, from which they themselves benefited, as did the social groups on which they depended to maintain the social order. The prohibition of usury in the society of that time is best thought of as a form of social control. Some types of capital were more difficult to control than others, and therefore more worrisome. The general principle, according to which capital can provide income for its owner, who need not work to justify it, went unquestioned. The idea was rather to be wary of infinite accumulation. Income from capital was supposed to be used in healthy ways, to pay for good works, for example, and certainly not to launch into commercial or financial adventures that might lead to estrangement from the true faith. Landed capital was in this respect very reassuring, since it could do nothing but reproduce itself year after year and century after century. Consequently, the whole social and spiritual order also seemed immutable. Land rent, before it became the sworn enemy of democracy, was long seen as the wellspring of social harmony, at least by those to whom it accrued. The solution to the problem of capital suggested by Karl Marx and many other socialist writers in the 19th century, and put into practice in the Soviet Union and elsewhere in the 20th century, was far more radical, and if nothing else, more logically consistent. By abolishing private ownership of the means of production, including land and buildings,